from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next in this morning's forum program, 20 years ago, California voters approved Proposition 187, which was intended to withhold public education and health services from those in the U.S. illegally. A federal court struck down the measure as unconstitutional, but the proposition is credited with galvanizing a generation of Latino voters. We'll discuss the lasting impact of Proposition 187 on California politics and the nation's immigration debate. That's next. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's forum program. 20 years ago, California voters, by a margin of 59% to 41%, passed Proposition 187, the first ballot measure of its kind, designed to withhold education, health care, and other public services from those who entered the United States illegally. It also required doctors, teachers, and others to report those suspected of violating immigration laws. Federal lawsuits began the day after it was passed, and Prop 187 never took effect in California. It was ruled unconstitutional by federal courts, and earlier this year, state officials officially wiped the law from the books. The effects, however, especially the political effects of Proposition 187 and its mobilization of Latino voters, as well as its serving as a model all the way to more recent immigration laws in Arizona, continues to this day. And in this forum hour, we want to discuss the legacy and the ongoing impact of Proposition 187, which appeared on the state ballot 20 years ago. Joining us for this morning's discussion is Peter Nunez, former United States Attorney in the Southern District of California and Chairman of the Board at the Center for Immigration Studies. And welcome to the program, Peter Nunez.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you with us, and also good to have Gary Segura with us, professor in the Department of Political Science at Stanford, co-founder and principal at Latino Decisions, a polling and research firm, and co-author of Latino America, How America's Most Dynamic Population is Poised to Transform the Politics of the Nation. Welcome, Gary Segura.
I'm really glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Hiroshi Montemura, who is professor at UCLA School of Law and author of Immigration Outside the Law. Good to welcome you, Hiroshi Montemura.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. And let me begin, Peter Nunez, with you. Peter Nunez, was involved in the drafting and the editing and the promoting of Prop 187. And from your perspective, it was good policy, and it would be good policy today. Peter Nunez?
Yes, it was absolutely the right policy then, and it would be the right policy today. Although I think the politics of the state would prevent it from passing 60-40, but who knows? Maybe we'd all be surprised.
Well, you say it's good policy and still would be good policy, primarily, I imagine, because it would inhibit or discourage illegal entry into the country and not allow for legals to have their jobs replaced by those who come here illegally?
Well, yeah. I mean, the whole purpose of 187 was to discourage future illegal immigration. By 1994, it was clear that the 1986 Federal Immigration Reform Act had failed miserably, and in spite of the amnesty that it had provided, all of its other provisions had failed to stop illegal immigration. And California was the state that was most heavily impacted by illegal immigrants, so it seemed like the right thing to do at the time, and at least nationwide, it's still the right thing to do.
Well, the California Coalition for Immigration Reform said that the reason it didn't go through the courts was largely then-Attorney General Dan Lundgren, that he waited too long.
That's exactly right. Once it passed, the Attorney General and the Republican Party pretty much abandoned it and just let it sit undefended in the courts for many years. In fact, I was one of many that met with people from the Attorney General's office during the ensuing years to try to encourage them to pursue the will of the people, and they refused.
Well, the will of what became really, and we'll talk about this, a large Latino voting group in this state was very much in opposition to 187. And in fact, it had a lot to do with really creating a large voting bloc of Latinos. As someone from a Latino background, you must have caught a lot of hell for your position.
I caught none. I mean, I caught none.
Really?
I'm sure there were people on the other side of the issue that resented the fact that I was in favor of 187, but it never manifested itself directly in anything, in any kind of confrontation.
That's almost reassuring to hear, because Gary Segura, let me go to you. This really did realign California politics and created a great deal of Latino activism like nothing else.
It certainly did. I've heard on more than one occasion people suggesting that Pete Wilson and the proponents of 187 should be given a medal by Latino civic engagement and advocacy organizations, because no one has turned out more Latino registrations and voters than that law and its proponents.
And why were, from your perspective, so many Latinos who were U.S. citizens against 187? Why did they care to be opposed?
So first, it's important to understand that the purpose of 187, the stated purpose of 187 and the actual effect of 187 were different things. When we look at laws passed since 187, including Prop 200 in Arizona and SB 1070 and copycat laws in other states, including Alabama, these are laws that are designed to really make life very difficult, not just for immigrants, but conceivably for all Latinos. Because the method of enforcement cannot help but be some form of racial profiling. When Prop 187 was passed, it allowed state employees to withhold government services from anyone they suspected of being undocumented. And that the basis of that suspicion is going to be ethnicity and no other. So the reason that Latino citizens of the United States, some of them third and fourth generation, opposed that law and really shifted their political behavior as a consequence is because they themselves may well have been caught up in the so-called enforcement.
So it galvanized Latino voters. It also hurt the Republican Party. It still continues in many ways to have a long-lasting backlash with the Republican Party. And the fact of the matter is it also sort of paved the way for more Latino lawmakers to come into office. The Latino vote and national immigration policy, so much really goes back to the legacy of 187. But I wonder about the fact that, I mean, by some people's standards, it even turned California into a blue state.
That's correct. So if you look at the voter registration numbers in the wake of Prop 187's passage in 1994, California from 94 to 2000 registered 1.1 million new registered voters, and 1 million of the 1.1 million identified as Latino or Hispanic. And that is a dramatic sea change. 94 reelected Governor Wilson. As a consequence, the assembly was under Republican control, and the U.S. House delegation from California was exactly evenly divided. And here we are some 20 years later. The Democrats control every constitutional office in the state. They have two-thirds majorities in both chambers of the legislature and a whopping command of the state's House delegation. So there's no questioning what the political effects of 187 were. And an important footnote is that between 1980 and 1994, the Latino population in California had been trending Republican. Now, it was still a majority Democratic group, but at each year, between 80 and 94, the group was more Republican than it was the year before. And it was only after 94 that Latino identity overwhelmed the social mobility of those second and third generation folks and sent them just rushing back into Democratic arms because they felt they were being targeted.
It's almost gone to the other end. I mean, you now have undocumented able to get driver's licenses. You have state-funded scholarships. Yeah.
Perhaps, but let's not overplay it. Life is still very, very difficult for the 11.3 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States. They're still demonized wildly in state legislatures. They're still blamed for everything in the rhetorical morass from Ebola to, you know, helping ISIS cross the U.S. border. It's crazy. Congressman Steve King denouncing dreamers as drug mules. The rhetoric is still really very ugly, and life is still very difficult. And the long-term solution remains a comprehensive approach to immigration reform, should we ever get close to getting that.
Let me go back for a moment to Peter Nunez before I go to Hiroshi Motomura to get your response to that. When I was reading about the original petition for 187, Peter Nunez, it talked about illegal immigrants or undocumented, as they're now called, bilking the country out of millions of dollars. And there were some really, in the petition, some pretty xenophobic things that were brought up by any standards. Not want to characterize it as immigrant bashing?
No, I mean, look at the facts are the facts. And just prior to 187 being drafted, the state had produced, the state auditor, I forget exactly what the exact title is, had produced a report documenting the costs of illegal immigration to the state in a whole variety of other categories. And look at the city of San Diego, the county, a lot of the border counties across the southwest border have likewise documented the costs of illegal immigration to the taxpayers. So that's not a fiction, it's a fact. It's often ignored and ridiculed, but it is a fact. And that was a large part of the reason why the people who initiated 187 thought it was time to act. Clearly, the federal government was paralyzed, as it has been ever since 1986, in trying to stop illegal immigration, and to the point of the impact of 187 on Republican Party politics or in California. The growth of the Hispanic community in California was inevitable anyway. It was underway at the time. It has continued. I mean, since the early 90s, we have immigrated legally. The country has legally immigrated 1 million legal immigrants every year for almost 25 years now. And so the population, the Hispanic population of the state would have increased, and clearly they would favor the Democratic Party based on a variety of other issues.
So 187, we're hearing Gary Segura from Peter Nunez, was not necessarily that strong a galvanizing force. And maybe I could get you to comment on what I alluded to before, the fact that, like I said, I looked at this original petition and it was like illegal immigrants, undocumented people were being blamed for everything from narcotics to urine and stench in the street. I mean, the sorts of things that really are pretty alarming when you go back and read.
That's right. And if any or all of it were true, it would be alarming. The problem is threefold. The first is that illegal immigration is always constructed as an error or a transgression on the part of the immigrants. And we never talk about illegal employment practices. But in fact, the American citizen population has always had it within their power to stop undocumented immigration, because virtually every undocumented immigrant works for a U.S. citizen. It's not like undocumented people are employing one another. So the reason there are undocumented immigrants in the United States are because of labor demands that the U.S. labor supply does not meet. So let's be honest about why undocumented immigrants seek jobs in the United States, because they're available. The second is that though they're going to be constructed as this dangerous population putting demands on state services, the vast, vast, vast majority of undocumented immigrants came to the United States looking for a job. And that is not exactly a value that we tend to look down on in the United States. And then the third is that we frequently, in some of these studies trying to cite the cost of immigration, which is meaningful, there are costs to be borne when there's populations in an area, some of those costs are actually offset by the overpayment of taxation by undocumented immigrants who are unable to recover any of the wages that are withheld from them for tax purposes because they can't really file a tax return, or they'll never realize any Social Security benefits from the billions of dollars they pay into the Social Security Trust Fund. Now, you know, that it is the case that there are some local costs borne by school districts, et cetera. But undocumented immigrants were paying into the state coffers. And if we would have an immigration adjustment policy that would bring those people out of the shadows and into the legal structure, they'd be paying even more taxes into the state system. So, you know, I this notion that all problems associated with immigration are the fault of the immigrants really belies who holds political and economic power in California and elsewhere.
Again, Gary Segura, professor in the Department of Political Science at Stanford and co-founder and principal of Latino Decisions, which is a polling and research firm, and co-author of Latino America, How America's Most Dynamic Population is Poised to Transform the Politics of the Nation. Let's bring Hiroshi Matamura into this discussion, who's professor at UCLA School of Law and author of a book called Immigration Outside the Law. And Professor Matamura, I'd like to find out from you just about the effect going back to 187 and its role, for example, in today's immigration issues. When we talk about Arizona, for example, targeting immigrants and demanding proof of citizenship, or when we look at Texas passing a law that couldn't go through the court process where immigrants are concerned, 187 was in some ways kind of a paradigm, wasn't it?
That's right. I mean, when you look back at 187, as everyone's mentioned, it's 20 years since it was passed. But when you really think about this in terms of the past generation, it's a milestone, but it's a milestone on a long road where state and local governments have gotten much more involved in immigration enforcement or in immigration policy in general over the last generation. You had a very significant growth in the undocumented or unauthorized population, really going back to the 1960s. And so the case that I think about in this context is a case called Plyler versus Doe. It's a case that the U.S. Supreme Court decided in 1982, and it struck down a Texas statute that kept kids who were unlawfully in the United States, kept those kids out of school. And 187, which was 1994, is a direct challenge to that. So that Texas statute is 1975. You have Proposition 187 in 94. And it's interesting to think about the role it's played in two respects. One is that in the 2000s, you have a run of other state laws. You have local laws, like Hazleton, Pennsylvania, Escondido, California, and a bunch of other places. And so, and they were, in many respects, followers of 187. And that then, of course, goes to the state level in Arizona. And about four other states more recently. So that's one thing. And the other thing, which I think it's worth putting into perspective, is not just that you have this timeline that runs from the 70s on to today with state and local efforts to influence immigration policy, but the other thing is that we tell the story today of 187 as something that was struck down, and it was struck down, and it was struck down because it was what the lawyers say is preempted. In other words, that it's exclusive federal authority. The state was getting involved in something that that intrudes on the federal power over immigration. But what actually happened is not just that. That the political efforts that went behind 187 and failed in the courts were redirected in large measure to Congress. And so you have Congress passing a very enforcement-minded measure in 1996 at the federal level in two respects. One is it's an immigration enforcement measure, making it easier to deport people, for example, much easier, in fact. And the other is that you have public benefits restrictions at the federal level. So the real story of 187 continues at two levels. One is that you see this in state and local efforts since then, and you also see it showing up at the federal level. And that's been a pattern that you see throughout American history, the back and forth between state and federal efforts to affect immigration and immigrants.
So it was a precursor to other laws in other states, like the one in Arizona, but it was also because of its failure at the state level. And we ought to mention here that it actually carried all regions of the state of California except the Bay Area, led to pressure on the national.
Yeah, I mean, remember this was, I did not live in California at that time, but I do remember seeing ads run in the New York Times, an open letter actually from Pete Wilson, and really calling on the federal government to do something about immigration. And you had not only a lot of pressure the Republicans, but also Bill Clinton signed that bill, and it was during the Clinton administration that you have a significant ramp-up of immigration enforcement, for example, and most prominently at the border. real shift in border resources and that sort of thing. And so, you know, one could say, looking at this in broader perspective, that that 187 had a history certainly within California, but at the same time, you got to look at it nationally. And I think that repeats a pattern that you see throughout American history. You know, California tried to keep out the Chinese in the second half of the 19th century, in the late 1800s, and the Supreme Court struck it down and said, this is a federal matter. You can't be making immigration law in the states. And and that effort, after it failed in California because the Supreme Court struck those efforts down, ended up being redirected to Congress. Now, that doesn't always happen, of course. In fact, it may not happen most of the time, but it does happen sometimes. That state efforts or local efforts show up in the federal level.
Well, when we go back to California, Gary Segura, I thought it was, it's significant that back in September there was a racial bill because of priority probably of Latino lawmakers. Governor Brown repealed it in September officially. But also the fact is that when Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor of the state, he said in an interview with La Opinion in 2006 that his support for it was a mistake. So you saw the shifting political tides in that to a great extent, did you not?
Well, sure. I think that the politics of immigration has changed in large measure in California because of the size of the Latino community and its political importance. I think, though, that if we look nationally, it's a very long history. As we just heard, it goes all the way back to prior to the founding. There are wonderfully disturbing documents written by Benjamin Franklin in the 1750s talking about how the Germans were invading the colonies and won't learn to speak our language and will never adopt our customs, and they herd together and in language that was very racialized. It's important to understand that immigration politics has a deep racial component, and that's been made more so since the late 60s when, you know, prior to the 60s, most of the immigration in the United States was from Europe for reasons including racial exclusionary laws that were referenced a moment ago. But then in addition, you know, we had this change in 1965, and now today about 80% of all immigrants in the United States are from Latin America and Asia. And so that introduces a more clearly racialized component. Race has always been part of our immigration debate, but it's a more clearly racialized component today. And so those changes mean that immigration support and opposition will go up and down over time. They're frequently sensitive to economic cycles. So opposition to immigration is going to come during a period of time when there's higher unemployment and economic distress, and then it will fade usually during periods of prosperity.
Well, since you mentioned that, and we're coming up on a break here, but Peter Nunez, I think it's important for listeners to know when we talk about the history of Proposition 187 that it came in the middle of a recession, and it came in the wake of the state legislative and analyst saying that there would be more than $200 million a year saved if 187 was passed.
Yes, that's right. And look at the same, I guess those that were involved in 187 would like to take credit for, or the blame, I guess we're getting for everything else that's ever happened in the country. But I think essentially what you're seeing and what you have been seeing in other states is the same instinct amongst the sort of the general public that there's something wrong with our immigration policy when tens of millions of people can come here and stay illegally. So I think that more than 187 explains what's been going on in Arizona and Georgia, Alabama, Oklahoma, a number of other states over the last 20 years. I mean, there is, in fact, a large number of Americans who resent illegal immigration, don't think it's right, think it ought to be stopped. They recognize the federal government has completely dropped the ball. I think they hold both parties responsible for the failure to stop illegal immigration.
And okay, I'm going to have to stop you because we're coming up on a break, and I want to give up the phone number. You can join us in this discussion. We're talking about the immigration landscape 20 years after California's Prop 187, but also looking back historically at it. Our toll-free number is available to you now. It's 866-733-6786. Join us, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the history and the effects and impact of Proposition 187 20 years after it was passed in California by a sizable majority. Did it spur you into political action, or are you angry that it was never implemented? You can actually post your comments now on our website or our Facebook page. Our website is kqed.org/forum. Simply click on this segment or go to our Facebook page, or, of course, you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. A number of ways of joining us. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or give us a call. Our toll-free number is also available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Talking with Peter Nunez of the Center for Immigration Studies, Gary Segura of Stanford's Department of Political Science, and Hiroshi Motomura of UCLA School of Law. And also talking with you, and we'll bring you into this discussion, I just want to get for the record, Peter Nunez, if I could, a little bit more of the history here, because I had alluded before to the original petition, and there was an unemployed accountant who was claiming he was bilked out of about $500,000 by an illegal immigrant. It later turned out from federal records that he lost $75,000 in a business deal, but it was to a former friend of his who was Canadian by birth and a legal U.S. citizen. So there was a sense that this petition came out of anger, at least initially, not only at illegal immigrants, but a kind of personal and maybe even it was painted as racist anger.
Well, I mean, the people that I know, that I were worked with in putting it together don't fit any of those definitions, so I'm not sure what you're referring to. I mean, Al Nelson, who was the former commissioner of INS, Hal Ezell, who was the Western Regional Commissioner, and a number of other people who were well-versed in the situation and involving immigration at the time were the originators, if you will, of this. I guess that's the only thing I would respond to on that front. But you know, when you talk about the impact or the effects of it, there's two other things that we've sort of brushed against but haven't specifically mentioned. And one is that the Clinton administration, which was facing re-election 2 years later, saw what had happened in California. They knew that it wasn't just California that was concerned about illegal immigration, and so they threw together what became Operation Gatekeeper here in San Diego and a similar plan in El Paso, which, as one of your other guests alluded to, greatly expanded the concept, or not the concept, but the number of Border Patrol agents, the fences, lights, cameras were put in place. So illegal immigration was a threat politically to the Democrats as well as to the public. The other thing that I think the other effect of it was that by abandoning the support for 187 after 1994 and by sort of caving into the pro-amnesty groups since then, the Republican Party has lost the support of the people who voted for it. So, you know, there were almost 60% of the California electorate voted for it. That was not just Republicans. There were Democrats and lots of independents that voted for it. And they would probably vote for it again today if they had the chance. But the Republican Party probably lost more of its base support by abandoning 187 than they lost from the Hispanic community for supporting it.
It was a fairly, and we should mention, by the way, since you mentioned President Clinton's election, that Gray Davis, who was vehemently opposed to 187, was elected governor in the wake of its passage or soon thereafter. But there was a highly partisan vote in the sense that Republicans favored the ballot issue 3-1 and Democrats proposed it 3-2. The Indies were at 22%, and it was a big gap between conservatives and liberals. But Gary Segura, on the other hand, Jonathan Wilcox, who's an adjunct professor at USC's Annenberg School of Communication and was a former speechwriter for former Governor Wilson, said to the Orange County Register that the measure garnered support from Latino voters, won by a wide margin of 59%, and I'm quoting him, "Nobody can say it had only the support of Republican voters or white voters."
That is factually not true. It is not true that a majority of Latino voters voted for 187. There is absolutely no truth to that statement.
I don't think that's what he's saying. He's saying that when you figure the percentages, you have to figure a lot of voters who are of Latino background. Not a majority, but a lot of voters who are Latino and non-white who voted for it. 59% being the evidence.
I would estimate that probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 in 5 Latinos voted for Prop 187. We could go back and look at the exit polls then to the extent that they were accurate. That said, that means that 80% voted against. And when you look at the 20% who voted for, most of them would have been self-identified Republicans, probably N generation, moved into the middle class. There's no question that people had strong feelings about immigration in 1994, and they saw the state struggling with its budget problems during the recession, and the idea that immigrants were to be a potential source or the blame for the state's economic disadvantages was a popular one. And there's lots of political gain, at least in the short run, from doing that from time to time. And so there's no question about that. The bigger question is, A, whether or not that's true, and B, whether or not the principal motive behind those who push such laws and those who vote for them is really about, you know, budgetary issues. If we look at what happened in Arizona, for example, it is not the case, as Mr. Nunez suggests, that these are just people who want the border controlled and want the negative effects of undocumented immigration to be controlled. In fact, the people who pushed SB 1070 through the Arizona State Legislature also pushed through a law banning the teaching of Mexican-American studies in state schools, which shut down a really successful ethnic studies program in Tucson, Arizona, which had a high rate of college attendance of its graduates. It banned the teaching in Arizona public schools by any teacher found to have an accent. And I'm sure the accent they were talking about was not an Alabama accent, but in fact a Spanish one. That there are broad swaths of anti-immigrant, anti-Latino legislation, policy initiatives that are associated with the people who push through these anti-immigrant laws. And the idea that immigrants are somehow or another to blame for California's fiscal problems in the wake of Proposition 13 and the wholesale problems that set into motion for the last 40 years in the state is just risible.
I want to go to your calls, but I want to give Peter Nunez an opportunity to respond to your remarks. And also, Peter Nunez, read a comment from a listener on Facebook who says, 187 is the best thing that happened to the Latino community. It is from that moment that we took conscience of who we were and stood up for ourselves. It's one of my proudest moments as a Latino living in the United States. And he means the fact, I suppose, that, again, it galvanized things. Peter Nunez?
Well, look, at good for her. I guess I almost don't know what to say about that. I mean, the whole issue of immigration, including illegal immigration, is a matter of public policy and to do what's in the national interest. Illegal immigration is not good. It's illegal. It's against the law. Congress has had laws on the books going back to 1882 concerning restricting immigration in one way or another. So I don't see how the body politic can do anything other than require our executive branch, judicial branch, legislative branch people to honor the laws that are already on the books and to enforce the law as it's written. If you want to change it, fine, change it. And we've done that in several ways, several times over the course of history. But the design of the immigration law is not to favor people, Hispanics living in California. That's not the purpose of the immigration law. And as I said earlier, the large number of Hispanics that have always lived in California, and which has grown significantly since the early 1990s, so be it. I mean, that's not a factor that I think should affect whether we enforce our laws controlling immigration.
Let me go back to you, Professor Motomura, on this, because actually there's an online comment. We're speaking about the law now, and a listener says, how can anyone say a clearly unconstitutional law is good policy? This law would target Latinos as they would be racially profiled. And let me just read one other pro-187 comment that I received by email and get you to respond, Professor Motomura. This is a listener who writes, Prop 187 would have prevented the vast closings of hospital emergency rooms in California, would have intervened on the decline of quality of education in the state, would have slowed the high cost of housing in the state, would have eased the effects of drought, would have delayed the development of multilingual ballots that are sadly so common in our elections, would have lowered the state prison population, and would have narrowed the gap between the rich and the middle class in this state. You would have been a less burdensome, would have seen a less burdensome tax on the middle class, more space, more resources, and a higher quality of life. Prop 187 was a winner. The people wanted it, but one single judge said no.
Well, you know, there's a lot of things going on there, but I think that the couple of things that go back to what Gary Segura was saying. I mean, we have a system here where the economy, driven by individual decisions made by employers, seems to have a very strong demand for workers for whom the legal immigration system does not provide any line to stand in. In other words, people say, why don't they stand in line? Well, it turns out that the system that we have is a system that does not make it, that does not provide any sort of any avenues for people to come into the country who are going to do much of the work that is needed in this economy. And I just and I mean work that creates and jobs for other for people who are already here, because they allow enterprises, businesses to stay in this country and to stay afloat. I mean, there's this myth that the only people that we should allow to this country are people who have PhDs and master's degrees, but there's a lot of people who do very important work to even at lower levels, with lower levels of education, that are essential to keep the economy afloat.
Let me just go back to this essential question, though. Was Prop 187 constitutional in your judgment as a law professor?
No, it wasn't constitutional. The reason it wasn't constitutional was because we have federal authority over immigration law, and one of the things we can't have in this country, and I think that this goes back long in American history, is that you have a federal sense of citizenship. I mean, that's really what the Civil War was about, is to say that it's not proper for individual states or individual regions to decide who belongs and who belongs to belongs in America. And to go back to something that Gary Segura said, a lot of this stuff is really based on racial profiling and on the fact that a lot of what's been going on here in, say, in Arizona or California. And the most troubling thing to me about the Proposition 187 is it authorized individuals in all sorts of situations, teachers and hospitals, in fact, required them to make judgments about who belonged in this country and who didn't, by deciding, well, if they suspect that someone is in the country illegally, then they should report them. And so what you have then is a system that says, well, instead of having a federal immigration policy, you're going to allow all kinds of people, not just state and local police, but all kinds of people throughout society decide, well, we're just going to delegate to you this authority to decide who to stop, who to report, who to harass. And that, to me, is the most troubling part of 187, and indeed of the more recent laws like SB 1070 in Arizona.
And I want to bring our callers in. They are waiting patiently. And let me begin, Jacques, with you. You're on. Good morning.
Good morning, long-time listener. I love your show. I'd like to share my experience with an illegal immigrant and leave a comment. We employed a nanny and discovered that she was illegal. We wanted to rectify it and get her papers, so we actually had the means to do so. We brought her to an immigration attorney who promptly told us that it's effectively impossible to get her legal papers. So the comment that I'd like to leave, though, is that I think part of the problem with the illegal immigration flow is simply that if you're not an educated person coming from any country, your options are essentially going into a lottery. So the comment I'd like to leave is our nanny paid a coyote $5,000 twice to come back and forth to go visit family, and why don't we just take that $5,000, create a visa, and put them into the system so therefore they're no longer illegal and then paying into us?
All right, I appreciate that comment. Thank you for it.
Yeah, can I respond to that?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. This is Hiroshi Motomura. That's exactly an illustration of what I mentioned. You know, Peter Nunez was talking about enforcement, and I think that what you need to do is to step back and say, what exactly is the system that we're enforcing? The reason we have 11 million people in the country who are without legal status is because we don't have a lawful admission system that meets the needs of the economy. And we don't have, and so this the caller's example is precisely an excellent illustration of that. And what the Congress made the mistake in 1986 of having an amnesty or legalization, and they beefed up enforcement, but they didn't do anything to change the system to bring workers into the country. And that's really the problem, and that's the reason why, as Gary Segura said, we need a more comprehensive system, a comprehensive solution that is not just enforcement and not just legalization, but also rethinks the issue of what the caller just raised.
Again, Hiroshi Motomura is author of Immigration Outside the Law, and our next caller is Cecilia, joining us from Oakland. Good morning.
Hi. I'd like to ask the speakers what they think the role of reproductive rights plays in terms of the immigration debate. I've read some of Michelle Goldberg's books, and you've had her speak about this topic in the past in terms of immigration. But, you know, the news this summer was highlighted by the overwhelming numbers of children undocumented crossing into the U.S. to be reunited with their families. And with everything that's happened, what really needs to be highlighted is the fact that women in Latin America have lack of contraceptive resources. They're in extreme poverty, and if we're trying to address this problem, we need to, you know, support our sisters on the other side of the border. What do the speakers think that can be done about this?
Well, let me take that from another perspective, if I may, because Peter Nunez, of course, feels that 187, because it was passed, should be in law. What about when it comes to something like reproductive health services? Those would have presumably under 187's aegis been denied to women who are here illegally and who probably could have used them to maybe stave off more of a population of illegals. Peter Nunez?
Well, look, at the point of 187 was to focus on all benefits that were available to illegal immigrants to discourage by removing those benefits, to discourage illegal immigration in the future. That's the whole point. So regardless of what the benefit was, the idea was let's turn off the magnet that draws people here illegally, and try in the future to not have to repeat the situation that we've been struggling with now, I guess since 1965, but clearly in the last 20 years. But look back to the professor's point about our current system. You know, we have a million people a year coming in legally. A million people coming legally a year. That should be more than enough to satisfy any needs that the country has for outside workers, and especially when you consider that two-thirds of the 1 million come here only based on their family relationship to somebody here. It doesn't matter whether they can read or write, if they have skills, whatever their education level is. Nothing matters. It's just that they come because they're related to somebody. The other third, which is about a little more than 300,000 people a year, come in precisely because they fit into some employment quota that is provided for in the current law, including a guest worker program. We have a guest worker program, and many people take advantage of it.
Let me read.
So we don't
this.
Have a system in that respect. Now, could the system be improved? Well, yeah, sure. If we need to tinker with some of the categories, some people have suggested that we do away with the family reunification categories altogether and make our legal immigration system entirely employment related. That makes more sense than what we've been doing for the last 25 years.
Again, Peter Nunez is chairman of the board at the Center for Immigration Studies. I just want to dovetail your remarks, Peter Nunez, with a listener who writes, America and pretty much all societies need cheap labor. The latest version of cheap labor for America is Mexican and Central American immigrants. To the whiners crying here about the influx, when your children are working the fields in the summers, take jobs mowing and blowing out front yards and taking care of our discarded elderly for minimum wage, then I'll listen to your rants about immigrants. Let me get some more callers on here. And this is Greg from San Jose. You're on.
Hi, I'm one of those people who started working in the 60s and the 70s in the fields. And this is about wages and unions. Cesar Chavez and the other union organizers wanted to organize farm labor to give a living wage for people who wanted to have homes and live in California and other states across the country. And this is what it's about. And he fought against illegal immigration because it was being done by the big corporations. And they continue to do this, as reported by the California Labor Relations Board. Nobody played fair. The corporations were smuggling in semi-loads of illegal immigrants to work the fields to keep wages down and to break the unions. So you have to look at the fact that people who do live here, who do want to have a living wage, and it all it rolls all up into labor, into the cost of labor, and it's all about wage suppression. So it's the employers who need to be punished, and this needs to be enforced for the quality of life of every person trying to have a living wage. The whole thing is all on them.
Well, I thank you for those comments, and I want to let them stand because I also want to go back to Gary Segura. And Gary Segura, I want to get your response to another take on the impact of Proposition 187 from one of the supporters of the proposition, Dana Rohrbach, who was a Republican congressman from Costa Mesa. And let me hear what you have to say about what former Congressman Rohrbach says, quote, "The lasting legacy of 187 is that the American people have again witnessed a fundamental issue in which elected officials totally betrayed a majority of voters. That has left a lasting sense of cynicism with a lot of people wondering how democratic our system is and whether the liberal left can just ignore the law when it's not benefiting their agenda."
Well, I can't even begin to dignify that comment with remark with any sort of response, because this notion that the left can somehow or another ignore the law is a rather interesting notion in a period of time in where, you know, the right devises new and better ways to exclude from the ballot box and the voting booth millions and millions of young and minority voters to try to keep them from moving policy in their direction. In the end, the courts decide whether or not a law meets constitutional scrutiny. In using racial profiling without probable cause to exclude individuals from the benefits of state residency and citizenship is unconstitutional. That's very clear. The majority of the public could vote tomorrow to deny the right to vote to African Americans or Native Americans, or to deny the right for schooling for Latino Americans. But that doesn't make, just because a majority voted for it, doesn't make it right. And that's why our constitutional system provides certain guarantees so that all Americans enjoy equal access to the benefits of our society. I want to respond for a minute to the several comments we've had regarding the employment structure. When Peter Nunez says that we have 1 million immigrants a year, that should be enough. Well, that's his opinion, but the economy demands the workers it demands. Now, we can argue about whether or not the effect of immigration on labor wages rather is negative, or if it's undermined unions, it probably has, and there's all sorts of forces that go into that. But at the same time, what we cannot deny is that if any of your listeners have eaten a piece of chicken in the last week, if any of your listeners have eaten a piece of lettuce, if they've eaten a strawberry, if their house has a roof on it, if there's carpet in their home, they have almost certainly benefited in one way or another from the low wages that are made possible by the amount of illegal immigration in the United States. Now, those undocumented people are exploited. Your caller was correct. They are exploited. They are treated badly in their places of employment. And we would like to see everyone live a more meaningful quality of life.
Again, Professor Gary Segura with us by phone is author of Latino America, How America's Most Dynamic Population is Poised to Transform the Politics of the Nation. I want to hear from more of our listeners, and we'll go to Bill in Stockton. Bill, you're on.
Yeah, the fact that people say we need labor is ridiculous because our U6 is like 20 million. And also the comprehensive immigration reform, the CBO says it's going to fail. It won't stop illegal immigration. It will lower wages. And, you know, it's got 35 million green cards in the bill. It's not about the 11 million people that are here. I mean, why do they print 35 million green cards when you only have 11 million people you're going to legalize? And the amnesty with a green card is instant.
Professor Segura.
Well, you know, the specifics of the of any piece, particular piece of legislation are up for grabs. I mean, one of the problems with the Senate bill, when you talk about the number of legal residencies that it would include, is that the bill is both dealing with present tense issues and trying to lay a foundation for the future. I think one of the interesting things that all three of the speakers on the phone would probably agree with is that if the U.S. had an immigration policy that overall made sense, that served the needs of the economy, that recognized the flow of individuals and labor for what it was, it might be a more rational system. But in terms of the specific aspects of any particular plan with respect to the number of immigrants allowed in any given year, I don't have a lot to say about that because that's going to change as the legislation changes.
Well, Hiroshi Motomura, let me go back to you. A listener writes, there is no way to say this is primarily a budget concern and not a race issue. The amount of emotion and action on the anti-immigrant side doesn't look like a financial issue. And on the financial side, there are huge benefits from immigrants. Silicon Valley is built on immigrant labor. I have dozens of patents where the co-inventor was from another country, and they stay here inventing, starting businesses, and the growing business hires many people at great salaries.
Well, I mean, I agree that, and I think Gary Segura made this point earlier, that a lot of this is at bottom an issue of race and ethnicity in the sense of who belongs. I mean, I think that the reason that we have a lot of the laws that, that have been proposed, like 187 or SB 1070, is a sense that it's okay to tolerate and to exploit immigrant labor in the country illegally, to look a certain way, not enforce when you need the work. But then all of a sudden, when the economy turns down, as it did in the early 90s in California, to all of a sudden be shocked that there's so many people working here unlawfully. And I think that's a lot of what's behind this. And one of the reasons I believe that, that to be the case is because it has to do with this question of budget figures. You know, of course, there's a lot of back and forth, and economists have made careers on this question of how much immigration costs or benefits. But the fact of the matter is all those studies really are looking short-term, as I think they have to. They really don't look at the question of what the what this country might do or my, how it might benefit from immigration a generation from now or two generations from now. And you've got to ask, you know, what's, why the unwillingness to look that far ahead? And I think that the unwillingness to look that far ahead is because, you know, of course, it's probably because it's unknown, but it's also an unwillingness to really look at how immigrants over generations have actually have benefited this country in ways that were hard hard to predict.
Excuse me, Professor Motomura. I want to give final word here. We've got seconds left to Peter Nunez. Peter Nunez, please.
Well, look, from 1924 until 1965, this country did quite well without immigrating a million people a year legally. I mean, we were down probably on average to 200,000 a year, and the country did quite well for about a 40-year period of time. So mass immigration is no longer in the national interest. We're not building transcontinental railroads. The Industrial Revolution is over. Yes, we need Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, but we don't need a million of them. So the idea is going forward, whatever the law, however the law has changed, there are going to be limits. There will be limits on categories and on numbers. And at that point, somebody has to enforce the law.
I have to enforce the time. I want to thank all of you for being with us. Peter Nunez, Gary Segura, Hiroshi Motomura. Thank you, our listeners. Forums produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. And our senior editor, Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.